From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Sarah Jessica Parker talks about her starring role in HBO's Sex and the City. She plays Carrie Bradshaw, a newspaper columnist who chronicles the single scene in New York. Carrie has one of the most interesting sex lives and fashionable wardrobes on TV. We'll also talk about Sarah Jessica Parker's early roles, very early. She first starred on Broadway at the age of 10 and starred in Annie at age 13. We recorded the interview last month before an audience at the Old Wailing Church on Martha's Vineyard. Sarah Jessica Parker coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Danielle Irby. President Bush has announced a deal on a patient's bill of rights. Mr. Bush making the announcement with Republican Charles Norwood at his side just hours ago did not provide any specifics of the compromise, which could lead to House passage this week.
We're going to work on the language of the agreed-upon amendment, and it'll give the members something positive to vote for.
Mr. Bush had been opposed to a bipartisan version of the bill co-sponsored by Norwood that allowed patients to sue their HMOs for up to $5 million in damages. The House is voting on a wide-ranging energy bill that President Bush is pushing as a key to meeting the country's future energy demands. The bill would open Arctic Wildlife Refuge to oil drilling and provide tens of billions of dollars in tax breaks for energy industries. Democrats contend the bill is too heavily geared toward helping energy companies with more than $33 billion in tax benefits over the next decade. An NFL Pro Bowler has died after suffering complications from heat stroke during practice yesterday. Minnesota Vikings right tackle Corey Stringer collapsed during yesterday's training and never regained consciousness. During a news conference this afternoon, teammate Randy Moss said the loss is devastating.
I don't even know how and when I'm going to get over this because it's hard. There's a lot of people here in America that's feeling our pain throughout the world. And we know Corey Stringer, number 77, is going to be missed. Running through the tunnel on game day, having his number called.
The heat index during yesterday's practice was well over 100 degrees. One man drowned and more than 20 Cuban migrants were taken into Coast Guard custody today when their boat capsized in heavy seas about 17 miles south of Key West, Florida. NPR's Philip Davis reports from Miami.
Three Coast Guard cutters and two helicopters are still out looking for survivors of the small motor launch which left Cuba's waters late last night. Officials fear at least six other people may be missing. Rescue efforts have been hampered by torrential rains and 8-foot-high seas. The captain of the boat has not yet been identified, a Coast Guard spokesman said, and the mystery further deepened this afternoon when two more capsized speedboats were discovered near the migrant smuggling vessel. One boat had two people clinging to its sides while the other was abandoned, but that boat contained several large plastic drums, often associated with drug trafficking vessels. Philip Davis, NPR News, Miami.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average declined 12 points to close at 10,510 in heavy trading of 1.3 billion shares. The Nasdaq rose 41 points to 2068. This is NPR. The Code Red computer worm is on the move again. The malicious program began rapidly spreading from computer to computer this morning, but does not appear to be slowing down the Internet. NPR's Larry Abramson reports.
Code Red is spreading rapidly to computers that have not downloaded a free patch. That patch is the only way to protect machines against new infections with the virus that latched onto over 250,000 internet servers last month. Security officials have been publicizing the need to install that computer patch, and that seems to have slowed the current infection rate somewhat. So far, the worm has only had minimal impact on the speed of internet traffic. Code Red can spread for the first 20 days of the month. It's supposed to die at the end of each month, but computers with inaccurate clocks may be starting the cycle of infection all over again. The worm hits computers running Windows 2000 or NT that are equipped to host web pages. That means most home users are not at risk. Larry Abramson, NPR News, Washington.
Operator error may have been the cause of this week's deadly explosion at a state fair in Ohio. Investigators believe pressure in the boiler of the steam engine soared after the operator accidentally let water hit red-hot metal. A Medina County detective says the investigation continues, but it appears the blast was caused by the manually controlled release of the water. The investigation is moving slowly because the two engine operators died in the blast. 50 other fairgoers were injured. U.S. officials say another Chinese scholar has been formally arrested in Beijing. China has formally arrested a Chinese-born American writer on charges of endangering state security, and another scholar with U.S. ties left the country after being convicted of spying. I'm Danielle Irby, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, maker of all-natural vitamin E, ADM, the nature of what's to come. On the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
There are thousands, maybe tens of thousands of women like this in the city. We all know them, and we all agree they're great. They travel, they pay taxes, they'll spend $400 on a pair of Manolo Blahnik strappy sandals, and they're alone. It's like the riddle of the Sphinx. Why are there so many great unmarried women and no great unmarried men? I explore these sorts of issues in my column, and I have terrific sources, my friends.
In her starring role on HBO's Sex and the City, Sarah Jessica Parker plays Carrie Bradshaw, a newspaper columnist chronicling the single scene in New York. Carrie has one of the most interesting sex lives and one of the most fashionable wardrobes on TV, as well as some of the best dialogue. Sarah Jessica Parker is nominated for an Emmy in the category of Outstanding Lead Actress in a Comedy Series. It's one of several Emmy nominations the show just received. Last month in the Sunday New York Times, Steve Weinberg wrote, "Sex and the City has the most consistently witty and insightful writing of any comedy show on television. It's also the most daring comedy on TV, not just in its embrace of taboo subjects, but in its exploration of the emotional recklessness women and men bring to relationships. Sarah Jessica Parker does some of the most complex acting you're ever likely to see on a comedy series." Well, here's the opening scene from the first episode of this season, written and directed by Michael Patrick King. Carrie and her three girlfriends are walking to an engagement party.
If you are single, there is one thing you should always take with you when you go out on a Saturday night. Your friends.
Why are we walking so fast?
Really? Are we in that big of a hurry to get to an engagement party?
What? Don't you guys want to go?
I did until I saw this invitation.
Yeah, let me see that again. Ugh. Two souls, one thought. Wow, that is sappy. That is totally not like Danny.
Must have been her idea. Two souls, one pushy fiancé.
Oh, come on. It's beautiful. Oh. It's a big romantic gesture to express how they feel about each other.
If two people have only one thought between them, something is very wrong. Whoa, Cap.
I remember when Danny had more than one thought, and they all involved going up my...
You had sex with Danny?
Sure, he's cute, straight, and we've known him for 10 years. Haven't we all had sex with Danny?
Oh, yeah, that one weekend that I was bored.
Just a New Year's Eve kiss.
I showed him a boob in a coat check room.
Just one?
I sensed he couldn't commit. Mm.
I spoke with Sarah Jessica Parker a couple of weeks ago at the Old Wailing Church in Martha's Vineyard at a benefit for public radio station WBUR.
Well, let me start with something that I think people really do want to know. Could you ever imagine living the kind of social life that Carrie Bradshaw does?
No. No, I would be exhausted, and I'm far too old. I am a New Yorker at this point in my life. I've lived in New York City for about 25 years, so I know of these people. I know they exist. I've read about them in the style section. I've seen them on Lower Broadway hailing cabs at unseemly hours of the night in tiny skirts. And my single life was not nearly as colorful as that, which is perhaps why, as a married person, I enjoy playing this part so much. You see, I have to, and it's sort of like legalized illegal behavior. But I think at this point in the show, 4 years into the run of the show, it's become, I think, more specific. I think it's about four very specific women in a very specific city, at a very specific time, and there's a sort of heightened reality to it, which may not really be consistent with single women anywhere, but I think it is the emotional journey that people seem to have responded to.
Did you have any reservations when you were offered the part about taking a part in a series that would have so much about sex and be so, for television, explicit about it?
I did. I was. I had a lot of reservations, most of them being about the sort of time commitment that I understood television to be and the fact that I really wanted very much to continue to work in the theater and also to be able to do films, and that I thought that that was not a possibility. Once we figured all that out, it was the content of the show. I never thought that Carrie was going to find herself in an environment that I objected to for whatever personal reason. I think it was more about the way we chose to illustrate, theoretically, the way we were going to choose to illustrate the situations and environment that her specific character, that there was an issue of language that I wanted to address. We spoke of earlier that Carrie is a writer, and I wanted her to be thoughtful about her choice of words, and I didn't want, just because we were on HBO, just because our boundaries were extremely large, especially for television standards, that I didn't want to take advantage like a child that has a really late curfew and then stays out 20 minutes past the curfew because you know your parents are lenient. And I didn't know how we would address that weekly. And those were the things that we talked about early, why Carrie would use language if, in fact, there would be nudity, which I don't do and haven't done and still won't do.
Well, I'm almost surprised that they gave you the role when they found out that you wouldn't do nudity, because HBO is kind of famous for breasts.
Yeah.
You know?
And we have some very good ones on the show, but they're not mine.
I mean, they'll find a way to
sure.
Like, have breasts even in shows that aren't about sex and the
yes.
city. So when they found out that you weren't going to do that, did they think, well, how can Carrie be the character that doesn't do that on the show?
You know, it's funny, when Darren Starr, who created the show, when he first came to me and we spoke about the show, I said right away, look, this is something that I'm not comfortable with, and as the years progressed, there's less and less of a reason for me to be taking off my clothes at this late stage. And he didn't even blink an eye. He said, that's fine. It's not necessary. It's never necessary with your character. It's only, in fact, if you feel comfortable. And that's the way all the women on the show have dealt with nudity. Kim Cattrall feels comfortable. She looks beautiful. It seems appropriate for her character. Cynthia Nixon's character, who uses more salty language, it rolls off her tongue, it feels right, it doesn't sound vulgar. When Kristen feels comfortable enough to take off her top or a bra, it's because she feels that the scene is appropriate. And so we found a way that at all times Carrie is wearing a bra, even when she sleeps. Like Marilyn Monroe, I tell everybody. So it's not really been an issue.
What are some of the plot twists that you thought, well, is this going too far or is this okay? For example, there was one about skid marks on underwear. There was another where
not having to do anything with my character.
Right. Can you still have a relationship with a guy if he is in the bathroom with the door open?
Yeah, this is all Miranda stuff.
Too much to take. That's right. But you're a producer, so you have to sign off on this stuff, I'd imagine. And then, you know, backdoor sex, yeah, as they described it on the show, and
once again, not my character.
Right. That's true. But
I think it's you take temperatures a lot, for lack of a better phrase. You see how actors feel about doing it. And what I've learned a lot from Michael Patrick King is, we get the scripts, I get the scripts pretty early. His thing is, don't sabotage the read-through. If you have strong feelings, and he means this for all of the actors on the show, the men and women, do the read-through 100%. Do the table reads, which you do generally between, we do it at lunchtime, like once every 2 weeks. Give it your all so we can hear where it isn't right. Because if we're halfway there with one foot out in the door and one foot out, and we're trying to see if a scene works, or if it is going too far, or if it's vulgar or unnecessary, we can't hear it if we're not completely committed to the idea of any of those things you've just mentioned. And generally, we try to err on the side of taste and humor. And we have to remember it's a comedy. And the deeper the show goes with the women, the more important it is to remember it's a comedy and that there should be helium at all times. And if an actor isn't comfortable with something, then that is absolutely taken into account, because it simply won't be good or funny if someone's not able to do it.
Two of the lead writers on the show are gay men. And some people have speculated that some of what happens on the show, particularly what happens to Samantha, who's the person who's really deep into sex, has more to do with like the gay male experience than the experience most women have. And I wonder what your thoughts are about that.
Well, I guess I disagree with that, because we have more female writers than male, and we always have. And I think that they're obviously, people's sensibilities on this show are primarily driven by the emotional search. And if the show were only that sensibility of an idea, a cliched idea about homosexual lifestyles, then they wouldn't be able to write Carrie with soul. And I think the beauty of a writer like Michael Patrick King and Darren Star, who's no longer with us, is that there obviously is a point of view and a perspective that they have because of their chosen lifestyle, but that is not what drives the show. And I think it's fun to sort of project onto Samantha in a general way that she's sort of this a gay man. But I think there are things about her that aren't specifically about gender or lifestyle. But that the other three women on the show are absolute archetypes, and they are intentionally so. We have Charlotte, who is hopeful and romantic, and Miranda, and these are bad, you know, two-word choices, but who is perhaps cynical and not trusting of love and what it might bring. And then there's Samantha, who is so comfortable with her sexuality, but they have to remain those for Carrie to write, for Carrie to be able to have this column. And the other thing is, I'm not even sure those people exist. I wonder if it's Carrie's imagination, that she has this vivid imagination.
That's interesting.
And that I don't even know that those women exist, because they're so beautifully archetypal, and because she's given them depth as the seasons progress, that she might just be a good writer.
Well, that leads me to wonder, and if anything I ask is too personal, you just let me know. But that leads me to wonder, if you ever had the kind of relationship with women friends that these women on the show have with each other, where they're always there for each other, and they can talk about anything, and they spend a lot of time talking about their sexual relationships, the details of it.
I absolutely have never had that kind of relationship with any of my female friends, ever. I have very, very close relationship with my female friends, and I'm reliant upon them, and I value them, and it's one of the things that I like best about Carrie, is that she loves her female friends so much, and that is the standard by which she judges men, that she wants a relationship with a man that is as fulfilling as her relationship with her female friends. But I've never been that forthcoming or confrontational or honest about that part of my life, because I just have never felt comfortable, and I don't think it's anyone else's business. And in fact, one time I was on a three-way conversation with my two best girlfriends in Los Angeles, and they started talking about something that embarrassed me, and they were talking for quite a while, and then they remembered that I was on the line, and they said, "Oh, we're sorry. We're sorry. Don't ask her about that. She won't bother answering." But it doesn't mean that I'm not curious and that I don't enjoy. And it's provocative. I mean, we end up, especially in the coffee shop scenes, because those are always sort of the topic of the week, it is they're provocative, and we all talk about it in the crew, but I'm able, like Carrie, to maintain some distance and get things out of the people and reveal nothing.
We're listening to an onstage interview with Sarah Jessica Parker, recorded a couple of weeks ago. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to the onstage interview I recorded a couple of weeks ago with Sarah Jessica Parker, the star of HBO's Sex and the City.
Can I ask you how you first learned about the facts of life? Not, I don't mean about you having sex, but just did your mother sit you down and tell you about it, and what your first reaction was when you found out?
My mother is a very progressive person politically, but she never discussed any of that with us to this day. And as far as she knows, I still don't know about... I think there was one boy in fourth grade, his name was David, and my mother was always pregnant. There's eight kids in my family. So my mother was always pregnant, and he said something about it on the school bus, and I think my head morphed into a question mark. And I think I sort of understood what he was trying to suggest, and that was all I needed to know. And I've never asked a question since. But because of the show, I've learned a great deal. I think of it as a PSA, a public service announcement. I don't know, it's odd. It's sort of inconsistent with my childhood that none of us ever spoke of it. Ever. I also recall one time in 1976 when my mother was pregnant again, and she was walking up 7th Avenue. We were in New York City doing a play and staying at a hotel, and then she was walking quite slowly, and we got to the hotel room, and my father told me my mother was pregnant. And I was so embarrassed because I think I understood, you know, how, and I couldn't look at her. I was like, I don't even want to think about it. Just tell me when the baby gets here.
What impact did the women's movement have on you, if any?
I think it has had more impact now than even sort of... My mother cleverly, I think, walked both sides of the fence. My mother is a very strong and assertive person, and it certainly took that for her to raise all of us with the little that she had. But she's also very old-fashioned, and I think only in my adult independence did I understand what it meant to have control, what I think I reap from the women's movement, which is about choice, more than about needing to prove anything, but more about the fact that I have the choice to go as far as I want all the things, as Wendy Wasserstein says, to have love and literature, to have everything and to not feel guilty and to not feel badly about only wanting to be a mother if that's what I wanted. And to me, it's more about choice, and I'm lucky that I work, I think, in an industry that allows that for women, more so even in television, I think, than in film. And so that's what it's meant, is that I get choice, and I can assert myself, and I can be aggressive and ambitious in the ways that I know how, because I'm not particularly ambitious. But that it's, I don't have to worry how people respond or to be afraid to have a voice, and that I am completely reliant upon myself.
Because when people watch Sex and the City, they feel like they know you, or they want to get to know you, and they want to, they want to know you above and beyond the character. But I think they'd probably make a lot of false assumptions about you if they were assuming that your character was like you. Being in such a high visibility role and being such a strong character on that, do people nowadays project things onto you which are just really untrue of who you are, and does that ever cause really awkward moments?
I think people say... the first thing that happened, I noticed, was because I didn't really... I had forgotten how many people have televisions in their home and even have HBO, which is far fewer than have... general network television stations in their home. So the first thing I noticed is that they would just say very intimate things to me about themselves. They would share very intimate details without provocation. And some of it was, very funny, and it would be good anecdotes for, Letterman or something. But after a while, I felt that I had deceived, it made me uncomfortable because I felt like I wasn't really deserving of it, and it wasn't my place to know it, because there wasn't a lot I could do with the information except thank them. But what I've now, I think, is that I had an interesting thing happen. I went to see a play, and I walked into this man's dressing room, and who I don't know well, and he said to me, "Oh, I didn't recognize you with your clothes on." And this is like a real theater act. This is like a big-time actor. And I thought, it's a thing that I struggle with the show, for those people who haven't seen it, that they assume that it's four women running around New York City searching for the ultimate orgasm. And it's not about that. And I struggle very hard to convince people that without forcing them to watch the show, which I'm not, disinclined to do, I would be happy to do that too, but that I don't run around naked on the show. I've never been naked on the show. You should recognize me with clothes on, because I'm, first of all, not Carrie, and second of all, she wears clothing. Less so than more, sometimes it's just a tea bag, but you could call it an outfit.
Well, speaking of clothing, she wears, incredible clothes. I mean, she has incredible outfits, and how do you dress compared to how she dresses?
I just wear more. I'm far less colorful. I'm far less daring. Far less daring. And really, I don't think my husband would be comfortable if I dressed like that. And I sort of honor his more...
You mean in a very provocative way.
Yes. Provocative or, yes. A lot of diaphanous things and...
A lot of navels.
Smaller, yes, exactly. And I sort of honor that about Matthew, because it's one of the qualities I like about him. And she's just a much more daring person and a much more eccentric dresser than I'll ever be. But I love wearing those clothes. And I think Pat Fields and Rebecca Fields have made fashion. Fashion, along with New York City, in my opinion, are the fifth and sixth ladies on the show. That the show, that New York is as important a character as any one of us, and that certainly at this point, the choice of clothing and the aesthetic of the show is equally as important.
Sarah Jessica Parker recorded last month at the Old Wailing Church on Martha's Vineyard at a benefit for Boston Public Radio Station WBUR. We'll continue the interview in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. By the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Wilmington Trust, a wealth management company providing investment and trust services to individuals, families, and corporations nationwide for nearly 100 years. And from Delta Trade Paperback, a division of Random House, publisher of Driving Mr. Albert, A Trip Across America with Einstein's Brain, a work of nonfiction by Michael Paternity. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, growing up on Broadway, we continue our onstage interview with actress Sarah Jessica Parker. She played Annie from the age of 13 to 15 when she got too big for the role. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Let's get back to our interview with Sarah Jessica Parker, the star of HBO's Sex and the City. Our interview was recorded last month at the Old Wailing Church on Martha's Vineyard off Cape Cod. The interview was a benefit for Boston Public Radio Station, WBUR.
Now, you've been acting virtually all your life. You were on Broadway when you were 10. Did you want to start acting, or did your mother nudge you into that?
Actually, my brother, Toby, was the first person in our house that was an actor. And I think what happened was there was a supplement in our local paper in the Cincinnati Enquirer. It's called the Mini Page. It was for children. I don't know if any of the papers here have it. They had a little ad for an audition for The Little Match Girl, which was NBC used to do their young people's specials out of Cincinnati. It was their version of after-school specials, and they were on, I don't know, twice a year at 7:30 at night. And we were taking creative dramatics classes, but everybody in the neighborhood did. You know, it's something you did on Saturday mornings at the University of Cincinnati. They had this program for kids, and I was also a dancer at the time. I was dancing with the Cincinnati Ballet Company as a student. And I just saw it, and I showed it to my mother, and I don't know what made me think that I even had a reason to go and stand in line on audition, but I just said, can we go? And she said yes, and she took me, and I auditioned, and I got the part of the Little Match Girl. And at the time, what I loved about it was they paid me $500 cash, and they gave me $5 after shooting every day. They would drop me off in time to get to my ballet lessons with $5. And this was 1973. And at the time, an ice cream cone at Baskin-Robbins was a quarter. And two hamburgers, french fries, and a Coke at McDonald's, which I wasn't allowed to have any of these things if my parents knew about it, was less than a dollar. So I had basically about $4 left every day. And I thought, you know, coming from no money, I thought, well, this is it. This is the life, you know?
You're not supposed to eat McDonald's on the way to the ballet lesson.
Of course not. Of course not. But I was fast. I could eat when I was a dancer. I would eat so fast, I would take a bag of M&Ms and just open my gullet and just pour it in, because you had to get it in you before my mom caught me.
What was the problem with it? What was the problem, that it wasn't healthy or that it was too expensive?
It was both a combination of not good for you and too expensive. And also, my mother always knew which company was building bombs for the war, or, you know, which company had shut down a nursing home in order to put up a burger chef, or Hostess was involved with AT&T, or, I mean, and they were involved in the war in Vietnam, or the lettuce we couldn't have because of Cesar Chavez, and they only used iceberg lettuce at McDonald's. I mean, there was a whole, you know, a heap of things that, I'm surprised we didn't starve to death with all the rules. And all the other kids in the neighborhood be going to, you know, whatever the local burger, you know, king chef. I don't want to indict anybody. But we weren't allowed. We had to have homemade hamburgers, and who wants those?
Your family was also on and off welfare for a while.
Mm-hmm.
What was the problem that caused the lack of income?
I think just simply not being able to make enough money. My stepfather was a truck driver. My real father was a writer at the time, and they just simply couldn't make ends meet. And my mother was not working at the time. She stopped. She was a school teacher, and she stopped when I was about 2 years old. And they simply couldn't make enough money to do everything that was required. You know, there were many times that we didn't have Christmas, or our phones were turned off. But the thing I want to say about that is that I didn't really know the degree to which it was different than anybody else in our neighborhood. I knew we were a little different when we didn't have Christmas presents. But I know that this is not an uncommon story. And I think the reason I didn't realize how different it was, especially because I grew up in an affluent neighborhood, was my parents were very smart about scholarships and free programs, especially in the arts. We could go to the theater and the ballet and the symphony for free. As long as we maintained a B average, we could take ballet lessons for free. We were given free membership to a swim club that my grandmother had been a member of for years, so we got to swim all summer and take tennis lessons. And so it was a sort of contradictory life compared to what our financial means were. But they were smart, and we listened to NPR, so we were educated.
How did you end up in a wealthy neighborhood if you didn't have money?
Because there was one house on the block, we always found it, where a crazy man lived. And it was in disarray and in terrible neglect. And I think it was some tiny, tiny amount of money to buy. And so my stepfather's mother gave them the down payment. And they bought it for nothing, and it was on a beautiful street, and it was just a wreck of a house, and we somehow managed to make it more of a wreck of a house. So that's just another example of my parents' sort of industrious nature, you know?
So when you were 10 and were on Broadway, in a family that didn't have a lot of money, what happened with the money? Did it go into the family pot? Did you get to keep it for your college education?
No, luckily I didn't pursue higher education, so I couldn't be too resentful later on. But no, there was an understanding that we were contributing now to the family. And the Jackie Coogan laws that apply to children that work in the movie industry in Hollywood and in television in Hollywood don't apply to children that work in the theater. So you could work 7 jobs in New York as a child, a performer, or probably even in retail, for all I know. And there was no laws to protect your money or your time. So the money went, I think there was a desire when we were making more money to put some away, and in fact my mom and dad did. But it was went into the family pot and allowed my brothers and sisters to have things that they couldn't normally have. And I think for us at the time it was the right thing to do, and I think it benefited us in ways that I couldn't even articulate. And I would do it again, and I think of it as an investment in my brothers and sisters, who we are very close and deeply devoted, and so that was the thing to do, and I think it was right at the time for us.
Must give you a sense of power when you're 10 and you're earning the money for the family, or at least some of it.
I think it probably does, and I think that my parents were very aware of that, and I think that was one of the things they were most concerned about, especially why they didn't want me to work in television and film, was that there would be an attachment, there would be a value to me as a commodity rather than somebody who enjoyed working on stage, where first of all you had to get your own water, you were responsible to show up on time, people weren't doing things for you and giving you obscene amounts of money, and you see things, you know, these child actors who have these terrible things happen to them and make terrible choices. And I think those were the things that were my parents thought of as landmines to avoid.
We're listening to an onstage interview with Sarah Jessica Parker, recorded a couple of weeks ago. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our onstage interview with Sarah Jessica Parker, the star of HBO's Sex and the City.
You know, we were talking about Sex and the City. You basically went through puberty on stage. I mean, age 10, you were in a Harold Pinter play. Age 13, I think it was, you started Annie for 2 years on Broadway. Did you replace Andrea McArdle?
I came in when Andrea was an orphan. I mean, when she was Annie, I came in as an orphan.
Oh.
And then I matriculated to the role of Annie. After her replacement left the show, I was the third Annie.
So, you know, if you're doing Annie ages 13 to 15, you're pretty much kind of developing on stage and going through those sometimes really embarrassing changes or at least puzzling changes on stage in front of people, plus you're doing it playing a child.
Yeah.
So what was that like? Did it make it more difficult to go through those changes?
I matured late. So those changes were more radical when I was doing Square Pegs, which were more appropriate to that show. However, there was a conversation about 2 months after I took over the role of Annie. The stage manager took me aside and he said to me, naturally, the year I took over the role of Annie, I grew 6 inches in a year, naturally. So he said to me, they were putting out a road company, and this little tiny thing came backstage. She was going to play Annie on the road, and she was easily a foot and a half shorter than I was. And he said, see that little girl? And I said, yes. And he said, you're getting too big. Put that on the back burner, he said, but just put it on your back burner, he said to me. And I thought, well, what are we going to do about this? I mean, what can I... And I knew that he was suggesting that there was going to come a point that if I sat on Daddy Warbucks' lap, that it would look... Daddy Warbucks' agenda, it would switch. It would no longer be about his charitable nature, his, like, mercy, you know, his, like, desire to be a parent. And I was very, very worried. And then I told somebody, and they said, well, you know, there's, you know, simply nothing you can do. And I did exactly that. I thought, well, you know, I don't want to be short. I really wanted to be taller. And then I wanted to go to high school, and I wanted my brown hair back. Oops. I thought, well, you know, he's kind of right to have told me. It's like this harsh life lesson. And for a second, I was like, I'm just like Judy Garland with the pills and Louis B. Mayer, and this will be chapter 14 of my book, you know?
Well, it must have been very difficult to make the transition from, you know, like, child star to woman and to, you know, adult actress. I guess it was lucky you had a transition in a way through Square Pegs, which is a TV series, a very good one, about high school and mm-hmm. about a couple of misfits in high school, so that even if you were feeling a little misfittish yourself,
yes.
that would have been perfect.
It
to
was
be
exactly.
In character.
And I thought a lot about that because my mother used to talk about this transition from child performer to adult actor, and that there was a really big difference, and expectations were different, and that she thought what I should do is only work in the theater during that period, where the way you are scrutinized was so much less, although I'm not talking about the New York theater critics, but the amount of numbers of people that you're exposed to, that you should just, she always said to me, just make smart choices now. Try to do good plays in New York where you just work on being an actor. And then Square Pegs came along, and she was very reluctant to let me work in television, very nervous about it. But she felt, my parents felt like it was a show about real girls and real feelings and what it's like to be, in fact, what I felt at the time, which was a misfit. I had been away from students for a long time. The minute I left Annie, I dyed my hair back to brown, and I went right to public high school, and I tried to fit in, and in fact, I really didn't. I mean, I had a couple of good friends, but it felt very right. It was a fortuitous moment, a short-lived moment, but just the sort of right amount of time to get through, in fact, what easily could have been a rough period if I wanted to pursue it as an actor.
Did you ever have a real high school life?
Not that was particularly satisfying, no. I tried, and I have my two friends from high school still. But I was so wanting to work and to be in New York City, and I needed to get out for unemployment, and they never liked that. I had to get out every Tuesday to go to unemployment, and they did not like that. Even though they said they were a school about, like, training, you know, they were all about, like, jobs and work. And I was like, well, this is about jobs and work. But I never really felt, it was a very, and once again, a very affluent community, and I just didn't feel like them. I felt different.
I don't know what you think about this, but it strikes me, I think of you as being a very bright actress. And
Thank you.
A couple of your roles in movies were about people who weren't bright at all, like in L.A. Story
yeah.
with Steve Martin, and even in the David Mamet film. I mean, you're the actress who's perceived as, like, the bimbo, and
right.
you want to do a serious part, you don't want to take off your clothes. And,
right.
and so I'm wondering, like, what did they... How did you end up, I guess it's because you're a good actress, but it seems like playing against type to
well,
me.
Well, that's nice of you. This is the extent of my vocabulary. When I leave here today, it is a little no. I always think of those two parts as very smart parts in a way. Like, I always think the woman in L.A. Story was Steve Martin's bimbo, which elevates her immediately.
Right.
You know,
right.
that she's very clever, you know. I think once before when we talked, I said she operates from the point of her sexuality, and isn't she smart for recognizing that and for being sort of intentionally cavalier about who she is? And wanting to be with Steve Martin, who is this very smart man in this movie. He's a weatherman, and he's complicated and interesting. And here is what we would normally call a bimbo, who has this interest in this man, not for any particular obvious reason. So I always sort of thought that she wasn't, that she enjoyed being kind of dumb, that it was fun for her. And clearly she wasn't particularly bright, she wasn't well-read or anything, but there was something cagey and savvy about her. And not unlike the David Mamet the part of Claire where she was smart businesswoman and manipulative and had very weird thoughts and ended up sort of getting exactly what she wanted in the face of all those terrifying men. And so, you know, those are sort of exceptionally written bimbos.
Did you feel like you learned new things from working with David Mamet? And he both wrote and directed State and Maine.
I did. I learned, and I was very nervous when I came up to do the movie. They'd already been shooting for about 10 days, and, you know, I knew that Bill Macy was doing it and that he is sort of the definitive, I thought, Mamet actor. And, in fact, he is so wonderful. He's a great interpreter of Mamet. But what I learned, not only from Mamet, but from watching all the other actors, is that there is not a wrong or right way to do Mamet. And Philip Seymour Hoffman, who'd never worked with him, who was so effective in that movie, has a completely different approach than, you know, William, than Macy does. And the same could be said for Alec Baldwin or David Paymer or Rebecca Pidgeon, and that it's about listening, and that with Mamet, it's about a seduction or a negotiation, and it's about being smart and on your toes. And he never once talked about lines. He talked about your body as a director, talked about how you used your body and where you placed your head. I mean, literally, he was that specific, and he doesn't love a... He doesn't, in fact, which was very good for me, he doesn't like a lot of gesticulation, that it's about the thoughts. And I learned... It's been a long time since I learned that much about acting and listening.
There was a terrific article about you that was written in the business section of the New York Times. Mm-hmm. And it was part of, like, how it was a series, I think, on how people spend their money.
Yes.
and so it was about you and money. But in talking about you and money, it talked about all kinds of it had all kinds of insights into your life, your career, your personal development. It was a wonderful piece. One of the things it mentioned that I noticed, and that a lot of friends came up to me and said, "Did you read that article? You know, did you see she and Matthew Broderick? They keep their money separate." And this was of enormous interest to people. And I think it's an interesting decision. And it's a decision I think a lot of other people have made, too. And I think it's a complicated one. I don't know if you're comfortable talking about that or not.
Yeah, well, you know, it's kind of a little bit about, you know, it's a little bit related to the question you asked earlier about not just the women's movement, but how my family life worked. And that I always feel that I am responsible for myself, that Matthew, because I am married to him, that doesn't mean Matthew wouldn't take care of me and my family and my extended family and my friends if need be. He's an extraordinarily generous person, and I would do the same for him. But I don't want him to ever have to take a bad movie or do a bad job that makes him unhappy because he has to support me. And as long as I have any earning potential, and as an actress, that window closes more and more every day as an actress of my age, I want to try to do work, obviously, that I can make a living and take care of myself, but that is meaningful to me. But I also don't want my husband to have to do the kind of work that he doesn't want to do. And
of course, you both have a lot of money, so it's unlikely that either of you is going to be starving.
Well, you never know. There's a lot of people we have to take care of, you know, happily, and you know, we have no children of our own yet, and we have to take care of them and provide for them. And I want for them to not have to worry in the same way that I had to. I want them to go to public school and do all that, but money is a very complicated thing, and I want my brothers and sisters to know that they can come to me at any time, and I want to try to save for that reason. But I also want to know that I can take care of myself if my situation calls for that, and I think Matthew feels the same way. You know, it's very vague. I mean, whoever pays for dinner pays for dinner. Whoever pays for groceries pays for groceries. You know, it's a little bit it's pretty loose that way.
Do you think you want to have children?
Yes, very much, very much. Despite Michael Patrick King's desire to have me in little skirts all the time, I would like to. Yeah, definitely.
And do you know how long Sex and the City is going to last? I mean, is it just like we'll do it as long as we can, or?
I think that we feel, well, you know, everybody always says this, but it really is true. You don't want to be around longer than people want you, and I only want to do it as long as we have really, really, really good writers, because that's what the whole show is about, in my opinion, is great, great writing. And as long as Michael Patrick King is there, I will stay, and my suspicions are that he and I will be there through, we will do two more seasons. How specific is that?
We're listening to an onstage interview with Sarah Jessica Parker, recorded a couple of weeks ago. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Our guest today is Sarah Jessica Parker. She stars as Carrie Bradshaw in HBO's Sex and the City. Here's a scene from an episode earlier this season. Carrie has just told her girlfriends that she's been invited to model in a high-profile charity fashion show.
New York Style?
Yeah.
You were asked to be part of that? That's huge. All the top designers are doing it.
Wait, they want you to be a model?
No. It's a mix of real people and models. I know the producer.
Carrie, you have to do it. You live for fashion.
I do not live for fashion.
How many fashion shows did you drag me to during Fashion Week?
8. What's your point?
Why are you turning down the chance to actually be in one?
I do not belong on a runway. Runways are for models, not writers.
What's the difference between strutting down a runway and the way you strut down Fifth Avenue?
Strut? Do I strut? Am I a strutter?
I think it'd be fun. I was a teen model when the Ralph Lauren store opened in New Haven.
Okay, it's amazing I was able to keep my lunch down just now.
I cannot imagine walking down a runway where people sit there and judge me.
No one would judge you.
Oh, we judge models all the time.
But you're not a model. You're one of the real people.
Exactly, and I don't want people to think that I can't see the difference between a model and me.
Oh, who gives a f- what people think? This is a fabulous opportunity.
Honey, you'll probably get to keep the clothes.
I thought of that.
I'd do it in a New York minute.
So would I.
Let's continue our onstage interview with Sarah Jessica Parker.
You know what I think is great? That just as you're in Sex and the City and your career has really taken off, like Matthew Broderick, your husband, is now in The Producers, and that's a huge hit. It's just wonderful that good things are happening to you both simultaneously, and that there isn't
nice.
The opportunity. I'm standing on the outside saying this, but I imagine there isn't the opportunity for any kind of unevenness or resentment that one career is moving forward and another stuck.
Yes, it's glaringly obvious to us that this is a good time because there are a lot of unpredictable, you know, jobs, but this is certainly one of the most unpredictable. And the odds of not finding satisfying work or not getting the satisfying work that you want are very high. And there are times that both of us have, you know, been looking at the other one saying, I wish I was doing what you were doing, or feeling good about what I was doing or what you were doing. So this is we feel extraordinarily lucky and know it's, you know, just a moment, and it will be different, but it's a wonderful, I'm so proud of him. I love the show. I've seen it 14 times.
You mentioned that you're concerned about what happens, you know, in a few years, because for actresses, it's much more difficult than for actors in terms of getting roles. What are specifically some of your concerns?
That I will be, you know, relegated to roles that aren't, you know, really fleshed out and interesting, that I will be, I just don't want to be sad about choices. I don't want to feel disappointed about the quality of opportunities. And so I try to be very realistic about what the future holds. I mean, I look at really wonderful actresses, some of the greatest actresses in my time, who struggle, who I've spoken to, who put their hands on their head and say, who would have thought that I would feel this way? Who would have thought that some young actress would be standing clutching a statuette saying, and you, I can't believe you're in the same category as me, you know, and the person's like, oh, I can't either, you know, you just, That's the truth. And men seem to be more beloved and more revered, and the lines are more interesting and sexier, and it's simply not the case with women. And the parts for women get younger and younger and younger, and it's not a judgment thing, it's just a keen observation, or even not that keen. And so you just try to be realistic, and you try to remember that that's why the theater, not to use it as a salvation, but that's one of the beauties, is that, you know, Blythe Danner can come work in the theater in New York and do wonderful parts all the time, and Maria Tucci and Marion Seldes and a whole class of wonderful actresses, and Meryl Streep, because there are great roles in the theater for women, and they simply aren't completely always there in film, and more so in television, though they are.
One last question. Did you already know how to walk in really high heels for Sex and the City, or is that something you had to learn for the part?
Well, I do love high heels. I love them. And I thought I walked in them pretty well, but looking back now, I realize that I have achieved a skill, a level of not only walking, but running in high heels. I could run a marathon, and I love the way it makes me feel, and I love that my character gets to wear those great shoes. I love them.
Do you get to keep the wardrobe?
I get to keep all of it. All of it. We give a lot of it away, and we use a lot of it for auctions and stuff. Like, I finally have something that someone actually might want.
But you said you don't like auction. To wear those clothes in your real life.
No, but I love having them. I have archives.
What do you do with them?
I just look at them and remember when Mr. Big was really nice to me one day, or when Aiden sanded my floors, or, you know. But the shoes and the purses I always use. Always.
And do you know what's happening to your character in the next season?
Now or in season 5?
Because you're shooting right
we're
now.
We're shooting now season 4.
Oh, you're shooting the current
yeah.
season. Wow, that's where we're
And I know
close.
Exactly what's happening. There's a lot of unexpected, wonderful, sad, moving, triumphant surprises ahead.
I look forward to seeing them. Thank you so
oh
much.
Oh my God, this
us.
Is a thank joy. You. Thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you.
Sarah Jessica Parker recorded last month at the Old Wailing Church on Martha's Vineyard at a benefit for Boston Public Radio Station WBUR. Our recording engineer was John Hoder. Our thanks to Gordon McGregor and to Jane Christo, Karamia Brancati, Courtney Barth, and Robin Young of WBUR. The interview was edited for Fresh Air by Anne-Marie Baldonado. Our executive producer is Danny Miller. I'm Terry Gross. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Audi, presenting Audi-assured certified pre-owned cars, including the A4, A6, and A8 with quattro all-wheel drive. AudiUSA.com/pre-owned. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
In case you can't hear so good, it's because I put the microphone at the wrong end of the telephone. But I think it's going to get better later.
Louis Armstrong often had his microphone on. He made hundreds of home recordings. We'll hear some on the next Fresh Air as we celebrate his birthday with Michael Cogswell, director of the Armstrong House and Archives. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.